The Emden Lecture has been given by some very, very prestigious historians, and of course commemorates our principal, A.B. Emden. I have to say, in my 4 years here, it's the first time it's been given by a historian that I have some form on. And I have form on Tom Devine because of two things. The first thing is his achievements. And I think even to a poor scientist like myself, you have to recognize what this man has done. He was a student at the University of Strathclyde, graduated, of course, with first-class honours. That sets the scene for the rest of this career, which is far from over, in economic and social history, followed by a PhD in the D.Litt. Roars through the academic ranks, as you would imagine, reader, professor, head of department, dean of the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences. And again, that gives you some insight to Tom, not just an incredibly clever person, but a can-do person. Then in 1988, he accepted the directorship of the world's first advanced Centre for Advanced Research in Irish and Scottish Studies at the University of Aberdeen. And Aberdeen then flourished as that centre over many, many years until 2005. And in 2005, he was appointed the Sir William Fraser Chair of Scottish History and Paleography at the University of Edinburgh, the world's oldest, most distinguished chair of Scottish history, which he took up in January 2006. Again, then, huge things happened in Edinburgh. Now, he retired from this Fraser chair in the summer of 2011, but returned to employment by invitation at the University of Edinburgh in 2012, January, to a personal senior research chair of history, which was especially founded for the purpose of getting Devine back on the books. He's the author of 34 books, close to 100 articles. He's been described in the press as Professor Tom Devine is as close to a national bard as the nation has. He holds honorary degrees, etc., etc. But you don't want me to keep wittering on about Tom, because actually I could keep wittering on, because you just have to cut out many of his achievements. Appointed OBE in 2005 for the New Year's Honours List, high media profiles, etc., etc. And I know Tom mainly, apart from his achievements, which came to my note, and that I'd read his books even before he sent me a very kind signed copy of his bestseller on Scotland. But because over many years, I chaired a committee of the Leaving Trust of 9 people that did every subject under the sun. Tom could have probably replaced all of us and done all the subjects under the sun, but in fact, all he did was most of history. And as a member of the RAAC committee, he also was taunted by myself at times of being passionately interested in the Celtic fringe. He's going to talk to us tonight about the death and reinvention of Scotland, and I think you're in for a treat. Tom.
Thank you. Thanks, Keith. As Keith said, and this is a great honour he's done me and the college has done me by asking me to give this presentation this evening. I first met him during the 6 or 7 years I spent. He calls it the RAC, I call it the RAC, the Research Awards Advisory Committee of the Leverhulme Trust, a tiny elite of 9 people who covered all subjects under the sun, from medicine right through to the queen of all disciplines, ACA history. And for some reason, Keith's chair sat at one end, and I ended up sitting at the other end, eventually. And from time to time, he would say, "What's the far north thing? What is the far north thinking then?" So the far north has come to Terry Hall today. It's perhaps not only bizarre, but perhaps eccentric, that at a time when The national identity of the Scottish nation has probably never been stronger. That I'm going to be speaking to you tonight about an aspect of the so-called death of Scotland. You're all very familiar with the fact that the nation is going to face a major decision next year. And there's a number of reasons why that has come about. But one of the significant reasons is this flourishing of a stronger national identity. This flourishing of a stronger national identity probably from about the 1960s, 1970s onwards. But what I want to do is to take you back to a period of agonizing about the future of Scotia, the possibility that the nation as an entity might be regarded as North Britain, a metamorphosis from old Scotia to North Britain in the late 18th, early 19th centuries. So a lot of my presentation will be about the 18th and 19th centuries, but I will try and return to the current situation, perhaps not the future situation, but the current situation in my concluding remarks. So first of all, the concern among Scotland's leading intellectuals of the late 18th century that the nation was entering a period of identity crisis, overwhelmingly, of course, due to the fact of the implications of the Union of 1707 and the thought that, as later commentators have put it, the thought of being in bed with the elephant. In 1759, the great historian William Robertson, principal of my own university then, who followed the last principle of a university in the UK to be tortured in public. The present principal of the university always mentions this. There's a resounding noise from the staff. Why was that great tradition ever abandoned? Because it's the public torture which the important thing is, not simply the torment, the private torment. Said, the union will make us one people. That was the first indication of the kind of thing that I'm going to be talking about in the first part of my lecture. And then when we move into the 1790s, the concern starts to build up. A traveller of the time, Robert Hearn, said, and he's especially talking about the elites of Scotland, the manners of the English, their fashions, their mode of speech are slowly beginning to take over. Moving into the early 19th century, Sir Walter Scott, who eventually did more as a kind of impresario of the invention of tradition, Sir Walter Scott spoke of the fact that what makes Scotland Scotland is fast disappearing. And then into the later period, Sir John Sinclair, the editor of, if you could call it, Scotland's Doomsday Book, the huge multi-volume parish-by-parish account of the country in its stage of transition and evolution in the 1790s. It is likely that the nation will be confounded in England. And lastly, Scotland's greatest intellectual lawyer of the 1820s, Henry Lord Cockburn. This is truly the last Scotch age. And that concern, to a greater or lesser extent, went on in terms of commenting on the assimilatory power of union and other forces, in terms of the sense of identity, in terms of the fact that the old nation of Scotland would indeed be christened by future generations North Britain. I feel like a regional geographical appendage of the entity created in 1707. Now today, it seems not only curious, but incredible that such things could be thought. But I want to begin by stressing to you there were good and cogent reasons why some elements of the intellectocracy of Scotland thought along these lines. One reason was that the elephant was undeniably larger and bigger than the nation to the north. The Scots were about 1 in 10 of the UK population in 1707, 1707-8. By any standards, England was more powerful militarily, economically, some might say, though I wouldn't necessarily agree, culturally. So the possibility in a full so-called incorporating union between these two entities, it was highly likely, some might even say predictable, some might even say inevitable, that the powers in every sense of the term of the southern kingdom, of the southern entity, would have a major influence eventually over time on the north. What gave good reason for them thinking this is that the London Parliament, and there was only 45 Scottish members in it after 1707, the London Parliament did not accept the Union of 1707 as inviolate. Instead, in two major acts early on in the Union, the Toleration Act and the Patronage Act, it interfered grossly with Scottish church government, one of the most sensitive areas of Scottish life in that particular period. And then, of course, the interventionism continued, as it had to continue at the time of the Jacobite Rebellion, the final Jacobite Rebellion, the fourth of these risings, to threaten the Glorious Revolution of 1688-9, to threaten the establishment, or if you like to put it this way, the Protestant establishment of Britain, and the continuation of the Williamite monarchy set up in the late 17th century. The intervention after Culloden was inevitable. Jacobitism, Charles Edward Stuart's army, had come far too close to success. The result was to draw three great Hanoverian armies into the north of Scotland, supported by the Royal Navy. The idea immediately after the slaughter of the clans at Culloden Moor, the idea was to transport comprehensively not only disloyal clans, but clans loyal to the Hanoverian state in their totality to the American colonies. That was then diluted, and instead of that, a reign of terror was mounted in the Highland areas to root out the recalcitrants, the clannish recalcitrants, the military aspects of the society. My memory of working on this as a researcher, it focuses often on the Disarming Act, which was intended not only to literally disarm these elements, but also to ensure that, if you like, the sartorial aspects of martial activity, the tartan, the plaid, the sporran, etc., etc., would be outlawed. As one Whig commentator put it, this is legislation. This is a law for not only punishing them, but undressing the rascals. I like that. And that legislation lasted right through until the 1780s when it was repealed, except for elements of the Gael, except for elements of the Gaelic population who fought in the British Army. And I'll come back to that later in the lecture. Okay. So in the 1750s, 1760s, it did look very much as if interventionism, not least military interventionism, was going to be one part of the relationship between England and Scotland. Almost an Irish-type situation. Almost an army of occupation. And those of you who know Highland Scotland, and especially the Inverness area, have got a great architectural symbol of that determination in the fortress, the greatest bastion artillery fortress built in Europe over 13 years, just southeast of Inverness, on the coastland, the coastline, Fort George Arbaceer. It's a monument in stone to the determination of the Hanoverian state that this would never happen again, that martial endeavour and clannish recalcitrance would be entirely rooted out. The other reason why there was perhaps a persuasive analysis behind the view of, quote, the death of Scotland, was the intellectual elements in Scotland themselves. Now, the great thinkers of the Scottish Enlightenment, Ferguson, Hume, Robertson, Smith, Miller, and a whole range of others, are constantly quoted by members of the current Scottish government. And so they should be, because probably the Scottish Enlightenment in its various guises, from geology to philosophy, from physical science to medicine, from poetry to architecture, is probably the greatest gift that my country has given to humanity. But it's also paradoxical when this phenomenon is lauded by a nationalist government, that the actual thinkers of the mid-18th century were A, overwhelmingly unionist, B, overwhelmingly internationalist rather than nationalist, and C, and this is the most important point related to the theme of the lecture, C, they regarded pre-1707 Scotland as a land of fanaticism, a land of intolerance, a land of poverty. In fact, they almost predicted what Professor Hugh Trevor Roper was going to say about Scotland in a later period. A man who had such a curious love-hate relationship with that country. Anybody who wants to ask me about Professor Trevor Roper's relationship with Scotland in question time and what Rupert Murdoch said to him the day before the presses rolled in the Hitler diary fiasco, I'm very willing to talk about that later. They, according to people like Professor Colin Kidd, these intellectuals, by carving up, by demolishing some of the historic myths which had bound the Scottish nation together for centuries, including the great king list going right back to the earliest times, mainly mythical, it's argued that they opened up an identity vacuum because all nations, so it's argued, need a sense, whether it's mythology or not, a sense of where they came from as a collective belonging in terms of mythic, if you like, mythic origin. And so by their very persona, by their political views, almost all the Scottish intellectuals, and I would include even Nat Robertson, because the tenor of that phrase I give you is one of welcome, of looking forward to a better future. So many of them talked about completing the union. And completing the union, they meant that there should be even more relationship. For example, the fact that Scots law was preserved in the Treaty of Union, that should go, because there were still signs of feudal antiquity and oppressive measures in it, at least until the aftermath of the Jacobite, rising of 1745, 1746. So theoretically, if we go on to the great revolutions in Europe of mid-19th century of 1848 et al., theoretically, the intellectual leaders of Scotland should have been the champions of patriotism, perhaps even the champions of nationalism. The very reverse was the case. They took the view that a better Scotland would lie in the cementing of the Treaty of Union and an even closer cultural and economic and political rapprochement with the South, whom they saw as a civilizing element, diluting the barbarity of an old nation, which was still in that condition as late as 1700. And the thing is, ladies and gentlemen, it's taken scholars of my country, it's taken scholars of Scotland about 30 to 40 years over the last couple of generations to unpick that and to reveal before us the true complex identity of pre-1707 Scotland, even to the extent of demonstrating that a core element in that puzzle, why the Scottish Enlightenment came about, a core element was its seedbed, to a great extent, lay in the pre-1707 world, not simply domestically, but in terms of the range of connections that pre-1707 world had with European centres of intellectual excellence. And it's still a surprising figure to note that between its foundation and the Reformation, the University of Paris had 19 Scottish rectors because of this consistent fertilisation, this non-insularity of Scottish intellectual life over a long period of time, right down to the 18th century. So the final aspect that, even looking back, could have suggested gravitas, could have suggested meaning in the predicted disappearance, or at least the predicted metamorphosis, or the predicted dilution of identity, lies in the area of economic and social history. I think it's still regarded, although there are some pinpricks of dissent, that industrialization in England was by and large an evolutionary process, aided and abetted by a series of consecutive accelerations, if you wish. It's equally the case through the work done again over the last 10 to 15 years in Scottish history, especially Scottish history done in a comparative way. You cannot write small country history, in my view, without comparison, without contextualization. And we're talking about a small country here because it had only 1.1 million inhabitants at Webster's census, the first relatively reliable census, which was produced in the late 1740s, early 1750s, before the first official census of 1801. So I've long taken the view in my own work, contextualization and rigorous, or an attempt at least, at rigorous comparative evaluation to put the country in its international context so we know what is distinctive and so we know what is dissimilar. So we know what is similar and representative. Now, without going into detail, here's the current, if you want to put it almost, the current orthodoxy on what happened to the society and economy of Scotland between 1750 and 1850. First, there were changes before 1750, but they were changes within a system, not of the system. The changes of the system, whether it be in industry and urbanisation, whether it be in agriculture and rural life in the lowlands, whether it be in Gaeldom, almost all started to kick in from the 1760s, 1770s onwards. Scotland's industrial revolution was a true revolution in terms of the semantic application of that term. And that's one of the reasons why, both in terms of the rural lowlands and the highlands, we can speak about a disruptive revolution. We have long spoken about the Highland clearances. The current generation of Scotland is now arguing for the lowland clearances. In my own work, for example, I have tried to argue that removal and dismemberment of the old townships in the late 18th, early 19th century, and the use of summons of removal, the legal writ to evict people, was much more commonplace in rural lowland Scotland and border Scotland than ever it was in the better known and dramatic activities. And the undoubted examples of oppression in the Gaeltacht and in the Inner and Outer Hebrides. In the 1740s, 1 in 10 Scots lived in an urban situation above 5,000. By the 1830, it was 1 in 3. By the census of 1861, it was 65% of the population. You know, the best illustration of this, at least the illustration I used to use to undergraduates, is that of the demographic sandwich. The first US Army Air Force photograph, or one of the first, of Europe by night. Three great blotches of urbanism and industrial development. The first, the Ruhr, arching into Belgium. The second, London, up to the black, so-called black country, although lit at night, obviously. But then there's the demographic sandwich. The fourth, Clyde Valley of Scotland. A sandwich of light, darkness to the north, darkness to the south. That was not a natural event. It happened because of industrialization, mass migration, and urbanization. And then one of the most telling statistics of all, especially, to me at least, especially in relation to England, a society which in terms of industrial and urban evolution was so far ahead of Scotland in the 1750s. When you look at the census of 1851 and consider the criterion or the definition of males involved in mining or manufacturing industry, occupied in mining or manufacturing industry at the census of 1851 in England, it was something of the order of 41.8%. clearly an advanced industrial society. In Scotland, the figure was 42.9%. Now, if you take that figure alone, it meant within two generations, Scotland had become the most industrialized country on earth. The relationship between that and my theme is one of the reasons why these commentators, especially of the early 19th century, talked about the death of Scotland and what makes Scotland, Scotland is fast disappearing, is because the anchors back to the old society, the anchors back were not only slipping, but were crumbling. That the new Scotland, the Scotland of industrial and economic modernity, was just so different, so radically different from what had gone before over the centuries, that it was easily possible to argue that there was hardly any connection between them, and that we're now dealing not only with a new economy, but a new cultural and social world for that particular nation. That is why, and I speak almost as an evangelist here, that is why, and for so many other reasons, not least what I've been working on recently, the global diasporas of this small nation and its impact, it's such a wonderful case study, such a wonderful historical laboratory, as long as it's contextualized and as long as it's looked at comparatively with other societies. It's not simply, therefore, teaching undergraduates and graduate students the history of their nation. It's not simply an ethnic action. It's also something which I think has got tremendous intellectual value for the study of the past per se. And I've been told that there are now several degrees being contemplated in Scottish historical studies in the University of Oxford. Is that not the case? Keith, you've misled me. Okay.
It's only the endowment
that stops. Okay, so clearly then, this is to some extent theoretical so far. It's trying to gain an insight into why elements of this class thought the way they did. But of course, they were wrong. They were over-pessimistic. That what emerged, well, I'll keep that for another 2 or 3 minutes. But what I want to ponder now is some of the reasons why the thinkers, or at least some elements of the thinking classes, got it wrong. These are only headings because of the time constraint. The threatened interventionism from the South, political, of course, and eventually martial, was short-lived. Between the end of the Jacobite risings and the 1980s, the elephant stayed on its side of the bed. In the 1980s, a female elephant started to move over. We'll come to that later in the lecture. But it's deeply significant for the history of Scotland and not least the referendum, which is coming up next year. The history of devolution, rather, and the referendum. Between the 1760s and well into the area of massive state intervention in the 20th century, a condition existed in Scotland called semi-independence. During the period of the late 18th, 19th, and early 20th centuries, Scottish bills were put forward in Parliament by inevitably sometimes English ministers, but those bills had been agreed by the Scottish quadrant outside Parliament and were very rarely opposed. There weren't all that many bills anyway, but that was the kind of informality of it. What truly happened in Scotland was that, as it had been before 1750, 1707, the management of the society remained at the local level. It remained at the borough council level, the Kip session, the range of voluntary bodies set up, especially during Victorian times, and staffed by Scottish professionals, lawyers, teachers, and a range of other individuals. The de facto position for much of the period that I'm dealing with was that the Scots actually continued to run Scotland. And then there's the linked issue of the Colley thesis. You'll all be familiar with the Linda Colley view of the tremendously powerful pressures making for the development of Britishness. Not very much in the book, about the development or the survival of Scottishness, due to the imperial connection, due to the fact of the two Protestant nations facing France over a period of long-term warfare, having to indulge in collective solidarity, and then, of course, the economic advantages of union, not least and particularly for Scotland. But I think there's a flawed area in her conception, and it's to see religion as an uncomplicated factor making for Britishness. I would rather see it in the context of this lecture that Presbyterianism was an arch influence preserving a spine of Scottish identity over the long run. Because the thing to remember, ladies and gentlemen, is the Church of Scotland was not simply through its assembly the surrogate parliament of Scotland. I can remember as a child in the 1960s, 1970s, sorry, probably the 1950s, 60s. I can remember as a child the Scottish Quality Press dominated by page after page of the deliberations of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland. Of course, no more. But it's not simply that. It's the fact that key institutions such as the Poor Law, aka welfare, education, schooling, and not only that, the moral values of the society, and for much of the 18th century, the pulpit as the main source of popular communication and ideas. And very rarely did those guys get out until they'd had 2 hours of it. They'd had 2 hours of it. And if you were a grammar school pupil, as Professor Adam Smith was in the 1720s, that's for the age group 9 to 14, after you'd heard the sermon, you were, I would say, almost coerced, because there was a draconian dimension to these schools. You should know, by the way, that their aim was to teach fluent Latin and Greek to kids until they reached that position by the age of 13, and punishment was handed out if they dared to speak English or Scots in the playground. So if you take somebody like Smith and his recollections into the schoolroom and dissection of the sermon after a whole week spent in the grammar school, the Scottish grammar schools demanded twice the number of hours as their comparator, the French provincial schools. And they talked about the fact, if you cannot continue, you lack, quote, the engine. It was almost as if, it was an ostentatious and overt attempt to create a ruthlessly effective intellectual elite. And of course, this explains to some extent the disproportionate influence of Scots in the 18th and early 19th century in so many aspects of the British Empire. It also, as an irrelevance, it also answered the question I used to ask in public lectures. How did it come about that some of these literati, and I'm thinking especially of the author of The Wealth of Nations, gave some of these texts as lectures to 14-year-olds, because that was the average age of entry into the Scottish system right through into the early 19th century. I used to think, especially since The Wealth of Nations is still a quite challenging read even for graduate students, I used to think there must have been some long-term genetic decline. But I think the answer lies in these horrendous in one sense, disciplinary sense, but very effective, at least for a small intellectual elite, the grammar schools. We've spent too much time thinking about the level below, the parish, the elementary schools, but these, I think, were absolutely critical. So if you have a kind of set of social influences, such as the Church of Scotland had, and such as the dissenting churches had, and such did the Church of Scotland have, especially from the 1790s, as the Catholic Irish started to flow in, which, how would you like to put it, crystallized Scottish identity round a Presbyterian or Protestant core. Some who don't know this history still find it surprising that in 1923, the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, it published its notorious pamphlet, The Menace of the Irish Race to Our Scottish Nationality. As late as 1952, while the same assembly was lauding the nationalist movements in Africa, they still referred to the Catholic Irish, almost all of whom were by this time third, fourth, and fifth generation, as an alien race. So that's the extent of the intermingling of immigration, especially of a so-called other, plus the extraordinary social influence of the church. It was very powerful in the continuation of a sense, and even a stronger sense, of aspects of Scottish identity within the Union. And then there's the final thing, the paradox, the puzzle. You know, the argument on one hand, the revolution in the economy is sundering links with the past. True. But what it also did was give nostalgia an enormously powerful appeal. This is the kind of world in which Scott operates, Sir Walter Scott. He gives magical appeal to the past, but that magic would not exist to the same extent through his novels if there wasn't an audience, a receptive audience for it. There can be hardly any doubt that one of the reasons for Burns' success, Robert Burns, from his death into the 19th century, not least among the diaspora, was because in language, in tone, and in social memory, he stood for, he represented the old Scotland, which was supposed to be disappearing. It was the individuals concerned, not only through their own work, but through the remarkable contribution they made to social collecting of folk tradition and publishing many of the songs of the old society, made a quite remarkable contribution to a remaining sense of the Scottish place in the past. And it may well be that a small coterie of Edinburgh intellectuals believed that the nation as an entity was fast approaching dilution. But don't forget that the ordinary people were still continuing to read the remarkable exploits, the extraordinary exploits of people like Wallace and Bruce through the works of Blind Harry and the various authors who had contributed sometimes mythic histories about Robert the Bruce. When you look at the literature available, either in book form or pamphlet or sheet form, to the, if you like, the Scottish masses, very much still a recollection of what had happened or was supposed to have happened during the Wars of Independence. All right, I now want to move to the final part of the lecture and say this. I gave a lecture something like this in Notre Dame in the USA, not exactly the representation I'm putting forward this evening, in Notre Dame, but the title of that lecture was Identity at the Crossroads, Old Scotia or North Britain. The concluding part of what I want to say is to argue that it wasn't a continuation of the old symbols of identity. It simply wasn't a manifestation of antiquity winning through despite all the intellectual, cultural, economic, and social pressures on it. By the mid-19th century, a variety of the markers and symbols of Scottish identity were either new or had been changed to such an extent that Scots of the 17th century would never have recognized them. And this is therefore about the permeability of identity. It's about its subtleties. It's about its flexibility. It's about its chameleon-like ability to change, depending on the aptitudes and attitudes and interests of the society at any one time. Of course, societies experiencing long periods of stability may not have to go through this. But to me, the question in 1800 was not the question posed by the intellectuals. The question was, how does one maintain the emotional commitment to something called Scotland while at the same time avoiding endangering the Union? There had to be a middle ground in terms of the symbols of identity to ensure that would, because so the Union was either for, in terms of perception or reality, regarded as the fundamental source of Scotland's growing wealth in that period. And its overrepresentation in so many aspects of the empire, to such an extent that, because Scottish people do go in for a degree of braggadocio and hyperbole, you know, you may have heard of the recent bestseller, especially in the USA, The Scottish Enlightenment, and the subtitle, How Western Europe's Poorest People Invented Our World and Everything in It. Now, listen, that is not a modest claim. I have written this off perhaps too rashly as the Burns Supper School of Scottish History. The other aphorism, of course, beloved of this nation, that on one hand can be withdrawn, on the other hand over proud. England ruled the greatest territorial empire the world has ever seen, but the Scots actually ran it. There is some truth in that, but of course it's only a truth at the core, and is an arresting destruction of complexity. So what I want to do now in the final part of the lecture is give you some examples, because of, again, the time element imposed by the principal of the college, and, you know, he is boss here. because of that time element, I'm only going to give you a few, but I hope I've selected for you some of the more interesting areas. The first is Braveheart, William Wallace. I have now to make a personal admission. For 6 weeks, I was the historical advisor to Braveheart and gave up the millions for the sake of academic integrity. So I hope you remember that when people attack me for other reasons. How does it come about that the great baronial tower, the Wallace Monument, 220 foot of it, was subscribed to and built near Stirling in the 1850s, 1860s at the high point of Union? The high point of Unionism. Answer: the Wallace cult of the mid-19th century was not the Wallace cult of the medieval and early modern period, and it's certainly not the Wallace cult of the Australian actor, Mr. Gibson. It's a different Wallace cult, and here's the way they got round it, and how Unionists could regard William Wallace as important as nationalist Scots regard them of the 21st century. The argument was, Bruce and Wallace, through their courage during the Wars of Independence, had saved Scotland from occupation and defeat, had saved Scotland from an Irish fate, and that meant, when it came to the late 17th century, whether this was a reality or not, this was a strong belief of Victorian Scots, there was a level playing field between England and Scotland, and a partnership union was achieved, not a union by conquest. So ironically enough, Wallace came to be regarded as a unionist hero. Undeniably Scots, but a unionist hero. The second example is the Highland Soldier. As many of you will know, after the Culloden defeat, Pitt and many of his advisors thought of channeling the undoubted martial virtues of the so-called clans into the British Army. They'd already been dabbling in this with the 42nd Regiment of Foot, which eventually became the Black Watch, even before 1745-6. By the end of the Napoleonic Wars, Scotland was the most militarised society, the most militarised region of any part of the UK, in terms of not only troops of the line, not only levies, but in terms of volunteering, far higher percentages than elsewhere. And the Highland Soldier came to be almost the new martial image of Scotland. Of course, in the medieval and early modern period, Scotland's greatest export had been men of violence to Europe and eventually to Ireland. But in this particular period, what I call Highlandism, and I'm going to come to that last in the lecture, took over the Scottish military establishment. Even in 1882, Lowland regiments, some of whom had fought at Culloden, were forced into tartan trews in order to demonstrate that the clans may have lost in 1746, but Highlandism had won in the late 19th century. that these imperial warriors were not only the cutting edge of empire to a degree, although they were far outnumbered by the Irish. One of my colleagues at Edinburgh used to say, Bill Ferguson, Dr. William Ferguson, "I know, Tom, they were better writers than fighters." In other words, what he meant was that they were pretty good at propaganda as well as fighting. When India left the empire, followed eventually by the last colony, Hong Kong, I was a senior officer, I was a vice principal in another university responsible for its international business when Hong Kong left. And there was a wager going on in the office I'd set up in Kuala Lumpur. The garrison regiment were the Gurkhas. Would echelons of a Highland regiment be flown in at the last minute to carry out the action? I won £100 on that wager. The thing was, they were the pallbearers of empire as well as the pioneers, if you like, the military spearhead of empire. But look at them, and especially look at the garb. But I think you could even look at some elements of Highland dress to this day, but certainly in the early 19th century. Unambiguously Scottish because of the tartan and the plaid. But if you look at the rest of the accoutrement, sartorially, they are imperial troops. So if you like, they represent, they're another metaphor for that hybridity I'm talking about, that duality of Scottishness and Britishness, which emerged in the later 18th and into the 19th century, partly through the direct invention of tradition, but partly through the other forces operating. The final area, which I've hinted at already, is this remarkable development, Highlandism. How does one of the most urbanized societies on earth by the mid-19th century start to present to the world in this period a rural face? Not only a rural face, but a face which is Highland. Why is it that bends and glens, why is it that the designer altered dress of the clans become important symbols? Not only important symbols, but I would regard them as a form of sartorial nationalism, a kind of substitute nationalism in the cloth. Because it used to be said until the recent resurgence in wearing Highland dress that the only time you would see it in Scotland was a Tory MP walking down Princes Street in the 1950s. That's changed completely. You will not go to a Scottish wedding today. You will not go to a graduation ceremonial but seeing so many hundreds of young men dressed as Charles Edward Stuart. How did this come about? It's a kind of alchemy. I'm almost tempted to say, read some of my work because of the time constraint. But here are some of the elements in it. It looks as if the more Scotland seems to be becoming more like England in a whole variety of ways, it looks to the Highlands for differentiation. Classic example of this is George IV's visit to Edinburgh in 1822. Looking back on it, Macaulay said, how did it come about? How did it come about that we presented our nation to our king, first king to visit Scotland since the 1660s, in a mode of dress more associated with that before 1707 as the dress of a thief? Because, of course, it wasn't just the fact that the Highlands were a kind of fringe area of Scotland. It was also regarded as a barbarous area and a semi-papist area. And at the same time, while this invention of tradition was going on, it was also being wrought. It was also experiencing havoc because of famine clearance and so-called agricultural improvement. That's one element. Another element is Jacobitism. How we move from Charles Edward Stuart as being regarded as the limb of Satan, that is an associate of the Pope, by the early 19th century, Bonnie Prince Charlie. In the 1820s, the three great canons of Scottish song, the most popular and the most frequently sung, were love songs, inevitably. After that, it was songs recalling Jacobitism. We moved to the later 19th century, and also visited Culloden Moor, the great cairn put up by Duncan Ross of Culloden in the early 1880s. the courageous clans who fought for Scotland, not Episcopalianism or the Stuarts or Roman Catholicism, the courageous clans, the graves of the courageous clans who fought for Scotland and Prince Charlie are marked by the names. And you know that you can see that whether these clans are a reality, given the havoc that was caused at Culloden, there is nevertheless on the moor named headstones. But the vitally important thing is, by that time we have the modern myth that this was an Anglo-Scottish conflict, whereas in fact it was a Scottish civil war. Because of the basic historical illiteracy of the Scots, since they've only recently started to be taught their history in schools, most Scottish school children, when asked that question, would say, what was the Jacobite rebellions about? Well, they would regard it as another set of wars of independence, a struggle. So the kit, if you like, the sartorial dimension of the clans representing Scotland became part of this mythology, that a way of constructing Scottish identity was to demonstrate these aspects of Highlandism. And what eventually gave a special charge to this, ladies and gentlemen, was the diaspora, was the huge movement of Scottish people outside Scotland. For every Scottish child, two Scottish children born between the census of 1801 and the Great War, one of them, if they reached past infancy, would leave Scotland. The diaspora, in order to continue to demonstrate its sense of cultural attachment, since it had no, unlike the Irish, political attachment to the homeland, because unlike Ireland, the union was secure, they consciously devised even further ornamentations, further dynamics in this area. There's a remarkable, there is a singular photograph taken just after the American Civil War of the South Dakota, center of the USA, in other words, South Dakota Caledonian Society. We knew the vast majority of them came from Lanarkshire. They are all dressed in the rig. It was quite obvious by that time the Highland factor, the Highlandized factor, was certainly affecting the diaspora. But there's one important difference from what you would see at a graduation celebration or a wedding. Because it was taken in winter, they're wearing trousers underneath their kilts. And that is totally unacceptable behavior. So on to the present day in the last minute. Cephalological investigation following one after another has demonstrated an increasing sense of identity of Scottishness compared to Britishness. But sometimes the questionnaire is such that it almost invites an inferiorization of Britishness, because Britishness in a true sense is probably banal. It's more accepted, unconsciously perhaps. In my view, having looked at the data, that old duality for most Scots is still there, the duality of Scottishness and Britishness. And the issue next year is whether, given developments which we cannot yet foresee, that duality, at least for a period, is broken. If that duality is broken in terms of identity, the union is lost. But I cannot foretell what's going to happen, because the future is not my period. Thank you.